So happy to give the last moderate the last panel of the day, and also get to moderate the only cancer-specific one, which is lung cancer, one of the most dynamic and interesting spaces in my mind, with a lot of different things that have been happening over the last few years that have really changed how we think about lung cancer and how it's been treated. So to start, I'll probably give a market and clinical perspective of lung cancer right now to begin, and then we'll introduce our panelists. Can I get my slides? Oh, sorry, I have this. All right. So just to begin, you know, non-small cell lung cancer has been forecasted to reach, you know, astronomical numbers by 2022 as evaluated by Evaluate Pharma. And that's been driven a lot by the immunotherapy drugs that are being developed currently and also already on the market, and the expansion in their different settings that will be occurring. Although non-small cell lung cancer is the major, you know, market driver for lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, which does make up about 15% of the lung cancer, does have a, you know, less than 5% of the overall market. I'm not saying it's insignificant, but at this moment it is. It doesn't necessarily mean it's not competitive, but that's how the analysts have been rating it at this point. So based on that, a lot of different deals and collaborations have been ongoing in the last year or so. As you can see here, these are some press release you know, headlines that shows the different broad types of you know, deals and collaborations ongoing. Well, most of these are with PD-1, L1 inhibitors and different combinations and collaborations that are ongoing that could potentially make it even more competitive. So this is just the timeline of how immunotherapy has, you know, really changed how non-small cell lung cancer has been treated from 2015 with the approvals of Keytruda and Opdivo in both squamous and in adenocarcinoma. And then this past year, Tecentriq and Keytruda getting approved almost simultaneously, one for frontline in PD-L1 high, and Tecentriq adding as a third option for second-line immunotherapy naive. And as you can see, there's also some more expected approvals this upcoming year and next year, most likely the Keytruda plus chemo regimen, which is in registration right now for frontline use without the need for a PD-L1 status. And then also beyond that, there's the sort of slightly delayed trials of the CTLA-4 combinations that will be coming. But when those do reach registration and then market approval, it will be very interesting. So here is just you know, the treatment algorithm of what we have seen so far, and how I think you know, speaking to many clinicians and leaders in the field of how we are treating patients at this point. So with adenocarcinoma patients, you know, if you are EGFR positive or ALK positive, you have those different first line therapies and also second line therapies at this point. If you're not, you know, do not have any of those molecular characteristics, and or your squamous cell, then you are typically looked at as whether you're PD-L1 high, where you then treat with Keytruda, which is, you know, recently approved, which has significantly shifted away the usage of platinum doublets in frontline usage, while there's still probably about 70 or 80% of patients that are PD-L1 low, which is defined by less than 50%. And those patients right now are being treated with platinum doublets, plus or minus Avastin. Avastin's usage is slowly deteriorating because of that. And then in second line, after, you know, you've been given the platinum doublets, you will probably be offered a checkpoint inhibitor, Opdivo or or Keytruda, but at this point, since most patients from now on will have already underwent a PD-L1 expression analysis, the limitation on Keytruda on second line may not be as great anymore. So, it is to be seen how that plays out with Opdivo and also with the recent approval of Tecentriq. So as you can tell, there's a lot of different things happening in non-small cell lung cancer, and there's a lot to discuss because of these many targeted agents and also immunotherapies that have recently changed the way clinicians are treating lung cancer patients. So this is just some of the topics that hopefully we'll be discussing. But before we do that, I want to introduce our panel. And maybe we'll start with Maria. You can introduce yourselves and across. And thank you.
Thank you. My name is Maria Kohler. I'm an oncologist working in Pfizer for the last 9 years. I am a vice president for oncology strategy, collaboration, and innovation. And I'm working in this role for last maybe 3 years. And before I was the integrated development leader for palbociclib. In the role currently, I'm doing a lot of sort of strategic initiatives, including business development, but also as a senior advisor for various agents within Pfizer oncology portfolio.
Hello, my name is Gregory Lubinecki. I work at Merck. MSD is how we're known outside the United States. I've been at Merck for the past 9 years in clinical development. I've been working on Keytruda, pembrolizumab in lung cancer since we began its development for the past 4 or 5 years, and I currently lead the clinical development team in thoracic malignancies for Keytruda's development.
Hi, my name is Steve Worland. I'm the CEO of Effector Therapeutics. At Effector, we're developing a new class of molecules we call selective translation regulators. There's a complex that sits downstream of multiple oncogenic pathways that selectively controls what messenger RNAs get loaded onto ribosomes to get translated. EIF4E has been around in the oncology literature for a while. Our first target is MNK, the kinase that phosphorylates EIF4E. And that pathway, the MAPK pathway, of course, is active in immune cells as well as in tumor cells. And using methodology we developed to map what transcripts are regulated, we fortunately found ourselves with a kinase inhibitor that simultaneously regulates through direct sequences in the messenger RNA, I'll note, not just generically, regulates LAG3, PD1, PDL1, because those are all coordinately and simultaneously regulated by the MAPK signaling pathway in immune cells. And not directly to the action of that pathway in tumor cells. We started it as a RAS pathway drug, but found out that it did additional things. So we're just finishing up phase one with that study, with that drug, and we'll move into multiple phase two trials in the middle of this year, including some trials in non-small cell lung cancer. So look forward to the panel. Thank you.
And I'm your token academic oncologist on the panel. I'm Charlie Rudin. I directed the lung cancer program at Johns Hopkins for about a decade and am now the chief of thoracic oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering here in New York.
Well, thank you very much. And I think this is a great panel because we do have the token academic. We have a biotech and two pharmas here. So we can hopefully get a good wide perspective on the ever-changing landscape of non-small cell lung cancer, and hopefully we'll get to small cell lung cancer discussion too. So just to begin, I want to throw this to Charlie because he is the oncologist here. You've seen what's happening in non-small cell lung cancer and how immunotherapy is coming in and really taking a hold of all the lines of therapies from second line, now moving up to front line. I mean, in your view, how do you see the platinum doublets playing out? Like, even with the Keytruda approval with platinum doublets, do you see it, it having an advantage over sequential? How are oncologists really going to utilize all these different type
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I think, you know, chemotherapy works. We're not done with chemotherapy. And the platinum doublets are have been a backbone for lung cancer therapy. I think they will remain a backbone of lung cancer therapy. If we look at surgically resected lung cancer, where the goal is cure, none of the targeted inhibitors, none of the sexy new drugs are known to be curative. Platinum doublets are curative in that setting in a fraction of patients, unfortunately not as many as we would like. But in that context, they remain the standard of care. It's going to be very hard to displace them from that standard of care because those trials take a long time and take thousands of patients. So, and these drugs work. So despite their toxicities and the fact that most of those curves do not have the sort of plateau that we're very excited about with some of the immunotherapy drugs, they remain active and certainly part of our standard of care now, and I would see them as continuing to be part of the menu for the next 10 years at least.
Great. So I'll have to ask Greg here. I mean, Greg, I mean, with Keytruda and with the chemo in registration at this point, and obviously chemos are very active, and you know, Keytruda is active in frontline also. Do you see that really altering everything and everything used afterwards? Like, how do you, I mean, you know, if this does get through and get approved, how do you see downstream from that usage? How will it affect everything else being used?
So it does. I mean, I have to say that I would agree with the opinion that that Dr. Rudin just gave. I think platinum doublets are an important part of therapy. They have an established role currently, and it's changing. What likely, I think what we're coming upon is, and this is to the point you were alluding to, James, the sequence. So what's the sequence that we should be administering these agents? So certainly if the FDA does decide to approve pembrolizumab plus platinum plus pemetrexed in a non-squamous setting, that could certainly alter sequencing and what you might choose to give later. I think we've also seen that with some of these agents, for those patients who are fortunate enough to have a long period of disease control, a patient who's been exposed to one therapy may be able to be exposed to that again at a later time and still have it contribute to their disease control. So I think this all just provides options for patients.
Definitely.
James, can I steal your role for a minute? And I know everyone wants to know Charles' view on the chances of approval out of 20 patients per arm for chemo plus Pembro in the PD-L1 1 to 49%. So that's what everybody wants to know. So Charlie?
I know Greg can't answer that question. So
yeah.
Maria probably won't. But Charlie will. let's get right at it.
I'll let Steve drive that one.
You know, the FDA has clearly been changing its stance on these things and taking a somewhat more, maybe more liberal view of approval approaches and what's required for approval. I frankly would be a little surprised.
I should admit, we have a vested interest. We're starting a phase two trial that depends very much on the outcome of that study. So we have our own bet as to how that'll go.
Having said that, I think the regimen is a good one. I think they may require a larger and more definitive study to give a first-line approval.
You know, my sort of very relevant question is, even if the doublet is approved with Keytruda or with any PD-1 in first line, do we think that the market is going to embrace it and suddenly treat everybody with this? Because it's not the case, it was never the case for Avastin. And why should it be the case with Pembro now or no, with any other first line PD-1? Mm-hmm. And is that the right thing to do? If we don't have sequencing data, and actually we do have sequencing data in some way, indirectly, because we do have second-line PD-1 versus chemo that is better than chemo, and that it prolongs survival, and all the patients got previously. So we have sort of indirect sequencing data, which I don't want to go there. We don't have a direct comparison, which I think the trial needs to be done.
Yeah, but I think that's a fair point. Yeah, so if we look at, do we throw all the weapons at the tumor all at once, or do we sequence them? What's going to be the optimal approach? Is chemo followed by immunotherapy or immunotherapy followed by chemo going to be superior to doing the combination up front, even if the combination looks better up front? Do you win in the end by having...
Right, and also, you know, there is no payer representatives in the panel, but is, from payer perspective and from a societal perspective, is it good? And the chemo is not such a horribly expensive part of the combination, but conceptually, if you have a doublet that works, do you really give the doublet first and expect that the payer will joyfully not ask any other questions, mm-hmm. and that the physician will feel comfortable to put the big weapon at the beginning? And, you know, the lessons learned is truly, for me, from Avastin, or for that matter, from, my old days, palbociclib plus endocrine therapy, where there are three randomized trials with hazard ratio of 0.4, 0.43 consistently, and the utilization of palbociclib and endocrine therapy in first line or in the market is 50% in US. So what other data do you need if you have three randomized trials with hazard ratio consistently 0.4, 0.5? Yes. You know, so it's not... I wouldn't worry that suddenly there will be just a bump and everybody will use it. I don't think that it will happen.
Well, I don't think that'll happen. I mean, first of all, certainly we know that for the patients that have greater than 50% expression of PD-L1, you know, they're going to probably get a checkpoint inhibitor alone. We're going to spare those people platinum-based chemotherapy in the first-line setting. For the group that's lower... there might be more interest in the uptake of a triplet.
Yeah. You know, and what you just said is why I am so excited about drug development, because we are designing these trials in the pharma, we are doing these trials, and then the market is doing something completely different. And it is very, 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 right, you agree?
Yes.
Very difficult to predict. And, you know, even if you have survival benefit, like with Avastin and chemo in lung, right? It's still not the argument.
Yeah. I would say the survival curve for Avastin was a small little difference, and there was a very striking difference with the Pembro first-line trial in the greater than 50%. So those curves, to me, are sort of a striking observation.
Second-line versus first-line.
No, first-line.
No, I know, but first-line, we didn't see the curves for first-line yet for survival.
Yeah. They're coming.
All right. So thank you. I mean, I think this is good discussion, but I think what's more interesting to the people in the room might be, so if they were a small biotech or just another pharma company and they were thinking about entering non-small cell lung cancer in development with a novel agent, is there still a place to develop a monotherapy at this point? I mean... You know, the way that PD-1L1s are being combined, right now with chemo, with CTLA-4, and with whatever else is in first phase one right now, or phase 1-2, is there still any place to develop a monotherapy drug in non-small cell lung cancer and be competitive? I mean, you could do whatever you want, but is it going to be used? Anybody?
Steve, you want to take it back?
Yeah, sure. So I'm in that position. You sound like, did you join my board recently? So I think it's very difficult in first and second line. Of course, I heard the comments from the previous panel about single arm trials. But if you're in patients who have gone through both the chemo and a PEM in a checkpoint, whether it was together in either sequence, those patients, of course, have very few alternatives. And so that's a high hurdle, but a realistic hurdle for a drug that's supposed to do something in non-small cell lung cancer. If you can show something there, I think that's very important. I think if you're going in first or even second line, you'd have to show that some patient selection schema that you have is so overwhelming that it will draw use to that agent. And, you know, you can hypothesize what those response rates have to be. They would have to be quite high, I think, with a durable response to say, let me impose a new slicing of patients that we haven't thought of previously, and then some subgroup of those will be treated with my drug. I think the challenge would be to ever get enough data to support that. It would have to be awfully compelling, I think. So for us, I think the way we think about it is to think about single agent in late stage as you know, typical oncology development in late stage patients, and then really think about where in that complicated schema you had before, where is the best place to drop in combination with a checkpoint and look for something meaningful that clinicians will really pay attention to, where you can show a benefit. And if you can do that, then there's probably some transference of willingness, open-mindedness to then look additionally outside of that setting. But picking that setting where you have an opportunity to show that you're doing something in, on top of the checkpoint, I think is what all small companies face. And to think that you'd go first or second line instead of thinking about a checkpoint would be an awfully tall order, I think.
Right, and I always like to look at melanoma as a guiding kind of strategy. I mean, you look at melanoma; they were the ones that got the combination approved first, and it looks like all the late development combinations are coming in, and it looks like non-small cell lung cancer could follow that similar path, where you're going to suddenly get these multiple different combinations, not beyond CTLA-4 and standard of care, that might be coming in with novel agents. And I'm just wondering how that would really change the dynamics of treatment. I mean, how do you choose in the end if you have multiple options? Any comments?
I think there's still room for certainly single agent drug development in non-small cell lung cancer. We certainly don't think of non-small cell lung cancer as an entity. We think of it as a collection of diseases that are very different in terms of their molecular drivers, and of course EGFR and ALK are the ones that you highlighted, but then there's RET and there's ROS and there's MET exon 14 and there's all these different subsets. And actually now for those patients, we're not, we're thinking about single agent targeted inhibitors for all of those smaller pieces of the pie, and KRAS is a big piece of the pie that's currently unaddressed with exciting agents that are coming down the pike, single agent for that. So I think there's space there where if we get a targeted inhibitor that hits the driver that is truly the oncogenic alteration driving this tumor, there's going to be plenty of room for drug development there.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk a little bit about that, with those targeted agents and specifically the KRAS. I mean, it looks like there seems to be some new directions to target G12C also, and they're all in preclinical, obviously. And also, they've been looking at different, pathways like MEK inhibitors and different things to try to, target those KRAS patients. And also for ALK ALK inhibitors, there's a lot of movement in trying to get into the frontline usage for those patients. And also combinations are coming in for those patients and also potentially with the EGFR. So I'm just wondering, how do you see the development of those targeted agents in the future and how will they be used? Anybody comment?
So as we know, the trials of immunotherapy exclude specifically the patients who are ALK positive and EGFR positive for mutations. And I think that what will happen is that the patients who have ROS mutation or eventually TRK mutation or whatever mutation where you have expected 80% response rate, those patients will be excluded. And we still have to answer prospectively the question, And maybe, Charlie, you can help here. Is the retrospective knowledge about the ALK and EGFR for PD-1s is negative, right? Do you think that there is a need for a prospective study of the patients excluded, whether there is any benefit, or do you not consider it unmet need? Because, you know, one would go into the question, you are using, let's say, ALK1 first, then ALK2 first, then ALK3 third. Is there a place where you will do ALK1 plus a PD-1 inhibitor? Whether this is a small space doesn't matter, but just conceptually. The same for EGFR, right? Because the PD-1s are not supposed to work or are not proven to work in...
Yeah, the data we have would suggest that they are not very effective in those contexts, maybe because those tumors are very different than the more common smoking-associated tumors that have lots and lots of mutations that the immune system can recognize. EGFR tumors are very bland except for a mutation in EGFR, and the same for ALK translocated tumors. They don't have a lot for the immune system to grab onto as a target, and they're not very responsive. The response rate is very disappointing in those subsets. It is an unmet need. I mean, you know, EGFR-targeted inhibitors are not curative for EGFR-mutant lung cancer, so we do need better strategies. The strategy of combining a targeted inhibitor with a checkpoint inhibitor is one that's being actively explored now. We've done this with, you know, erlotinib plus the PD-L1 drug from Genentech as a combination, and now doing the same in the ALK space. So these are being looked at. We'll see if they hold up. I think we probably need a different strategy for tumors.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
So do you think the strategy might be talk a little bit about biomarkers? I mean, a little bit some sort of companion diagnostic. Or do you think that kind of there might be something that might be developed in the future to really see which are the patients that could, you know, benefit from that targeted therapy along with the PD-1 or L1s? I mean, is that being looked at?
Certainly lots of people are looking at biomarkers for prediction of PD-1, PD-L1 directed therapies, and PD-L1 expression, of course, is an enrichment factor, as is mutation burden. But there's probably more to learn there. Within the context of the driver mutant positive tumors, I would say there's been less exploration there because there are very few responders, so you have very few patients to actually look at in terms of a predictive biomarker for response. I don't know what we would look for there.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. If you had a RAS inhibitor of some sort that you think works, okay, in lung cancer. It's some MEK pathway or MINK or whatever you want.
Stevens drug.
Stevens drug, yeah. Would you develop it? So the RAS population is known, RAS positive population is known to have a very significant response to the PD-1 inhibitors, right? And the PD-1 inhibitors are indirectly approved in the RAS population because they are approved in everything except for the EGFR and da-da-da. So if you are asking a question of the RAS inhibitor, what would be your control arm and what would be your approach to develop this? Would you go against PD-1 inhibitor or checkpoint inhibitor, or would you go with, or would you go versus chemo because it's still standard of care?
So I think all of those are possible, and it really depends how good the drug looks. And so the easiest route to approval for a KRAS mutant drug is probably not in the first or second line setting where we have, as you point out, there's defined therapies, platinum doublets, immunotherapy that may have, you know, a substantial effect there. For recurrent disease, there where your standard might be docetaxel, you know, that's a pretty low bar.
Now, is the docetaxel still the standard? You know, is it fair for to develop it?
For patients who fail the platinum doublet and immunotherapy?
Oh, yeah, and immunotherapy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of those people. So that would be an approval strategy where the bar is relatively low. If the drug looks great, of course, you push it up front, but it would have to look pretty great.
I mean, maybe I can just comment. So we have a drug that is in the RAS pathway. I'll say I think, going downstream in the RAS pathway, it's very difficult to inhibit everything that RAS does by not acting directly at RAS. So, and we're, several kinases downstream, so we only probably do inhibit part of the RAS-driven signaling. But I think that our exact strategy is, as Charlie mentioned, first go in late stage as single agent, and if it looks fantastic, we could think about this in some other context, but it seems to require less of the drug but may still capture the benefit to combine it with a checkpoint in earlier settings. And we don't view those as conflicting with each other. In the refractory patients, there is docetaxel. There's really not very much. And so if there's activity there and you can show that it's due to RAS status, great. If there's activity there, frankly, that's fine, okay. I think we would think first look to combine it with a checkpoint in earlier settings. And then only if the drug were looking really strong, single agent, and we saw a very clear association between RAS status and RAS wild type as being predictive of activity, you might think about would you go against something else. But you also would still have a very tough challenge. Why not try to go for the best outcome in combination from a small company with limited resources developing the drug? Going up against the best thing you could go up against it is a very difficult decision to make versus if I could further augment activity. There's nothing wrong with that from an approval point of view. Of course, you have to randomize it and do it correctly.
Just a slightly different view on this. Have you guys ever thought about, instead of combining with the PD-1L1, which I think is very intuitive for everyone who's developing non-small cell lung cancer, but to maybe combine with a different node within the same pathway? I mean, it seems that it might be an escape mechanism that makes the MEK inhibitor is not working. So we've seen in colorectal cancer but again, that's a PD-L1 they combine with a cobimetinib and it works. So has that been something that's running through, at Pfizer or other effector or even Charlie, if you guys have been thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, MEK plus ERK is a pretty well-defined combination for say, BRAF mutant melanoma, now a standard and clearly effective in lung cancer with BRAF as well, and a strategy that's being explored in KRAS. Same pathway.
And I agree. Certainly, companies that are developing with the checkpoint inhibitors have said they'd like to see it as kind of a backbone of therapy. It's not the only pathway that's out there, and the biology is very complex. And as we all know, there are multiple pathways. And so any avenue that allows us to enhance disease control, I think, is a win for patients and society. So,
yeah, great. I mean, I think a question, as we talk, the common theme is combinations, But how do you think the future of combination is going to be in non-small cell lung cancer? Is it going to be the rational approach, if there is such a thing, or is it all going to be empirical testing at this point? I mean, I'm sure every one of your companies has your own strategy, but, is it tenable to continually doing this? I mean, I think this is a common theme that we talked about throughout the day here, whether you can keep on running as many different types of trials, or is there some sort of more rational approach that is coming into play, or is it just whatever, is available to be combined with? How is that thinking in non-small cell lung cancer specifically?
I think that the concept of rational, live and learn, I don't know what rational is, because unless you have a very, very, very obvious driver, most of the drivers that we know, or most of the targets that we know are sort of more wishy-washy, like PI3 kinase or PD-1 or even the MEK pathway. It is not, just like you said, right, there is a lot of little things in the RAS pathway that you cannot just go and block it like you block EGFR or ALK. So I think that the rational combinations is a dream most of the time. I think that, you know, it's a truism. You cannot do all combinations that you can dream of. So maybe we should do more sequencing and more sort of answering the question, how do you prolong the patient's living with cancer instead of trying to shrink the tumor. So, if you know, it's maybe not an easy developmental path, but eventually the market tells us that this is where the market eventually wants us to go. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's too philosophical, but...
I mean, James, the way we look at this a little bit is I think you have to buy some data. So if you think you can sit a priori from a preclinical package and an understanding of the pathway and rationally combine everything, I think that could be difficult unless, as you said, it's really obvious and you say, you know, there's precedent for that or the, you know, preclinical data is overwhelming. But so I do think you have to plan to do some smaller translational studies with committed centers that are going to gather a lot of data and ask their very thoughtful questions about what is my drug doing alone and what is my drug doing in combination. And so I would say maybe those early trials are fairly empirical, but the campaign for gathering data is not empirical. It's well-informed. And then, you know, our belief, and I think other people's would be that, from there, then you might be able to do a more rational combination in a larger study that will really be, you know, mechanism-based, but mechanism-based on what's happening with infiltrating lymphocytes and what's happening with markers in the blood, what's happening to clonality, both T-cell and the tumor clonality. I think you have to be willing to buy some of that data, and you have to have very well-designed early studies with the right committed centers that will get you data from biopsies and will really be careful about the allocation of that material, because you immediately can dream up more assays than you'll have material to assay. And maybe that will help us move down the direction towards rational combinations as a second round after a first round that is, you know, empirical in design but thoughtful in its examination of data and capture of data. Got to get the data before you can think about it.
I mean, I agree with that, and I think that another factor that we need to consider is that looking further downstream, assuming that a combination demonstrates its enhanced efficacy, while it's less of an issue right now in the United States, a lot of payers in other countries are demanding to see data in these subgroups, and they're only going to provide reimbursement for those groups that they feel are getting truly the enhanced benefit. And so that reinforces the need for the data just so that patients are able to access the combination.
So, I mean, in the end, I mean, it comes back to that predictive biomarkers, you know, idea. I mean, is that going to be what drives the next level of combinations, or are we able to just continue developing just based on PD-L1 expression? Any ideas?
Well, I think you know, as I think the era of pure empiricism in phase one is probably over. That is, nobody develops a drug without a thought to what its target is and what its population is going to be. You know, we used to do that, but now I think, you know, we have some idea when you create a drug what it's going to be used for, and it may end up being different than what you thought it was. You know, and certainly some degree of empiricism and exploration is going to be part of these trials. But I think there's going to be a path, which is probably biomarker directed. So companion diagnostics are a key part of what we do, and the sort of exploration in early phase trials to try to define which biomarkers are actually going to be predictive is a key part of the business. I think within immunotherapy, you know, as we're learning more about the immune microenvironment and newer immunotherapy drugs are beginning to be explored, new targets, it's going to become increasingly complex but increasingly important to begin to look at, to continue to look at pretty deeply at the immune microenvironment and what's going on. Because as we move beyond PD-1 and PD-L1 directed therapies to other targets in the immune space, it's going to add another level of complexity.
I completely agree on that. I think right now, just based on what is in the clinical pipeline, it just seems like you could get overwhelmed by what could be coming. But if you can further segment your patient population by some sort of marker, then it might be a little easier as an oncologist to figure out how to actually treat your patients. But that seems to be something that's down the line, right? It's not anything that's going to happen in the near term, something like that. Or when do you think that something like that could happen, where you have some sort of guidance of that sort beyond PD-L1?
Well, I guess it's a pretty broad question. I would say, our approach at Sloan to our early phase drug development program is everyone gets sequenced. So we sequence 410 cancer-related genes on basically everyone who walks in the door, and there's now this database of, 16,000 people that have this panel. And we use those to direct people into particular trials. We have a pretty sophisticated system for if we have a drug that we think is going to be an NTRK inhibitor, 1% kind of population, we'll find those people and direct them to the right trial. There's actually an automated system that if that mutation comes up on anyone sequenced in the entire center, an email goes to the PI of that trial saying, hey, we found one. And an automated email goes to the treating physician saying, oh, by the way, your patient has this mutation. There's a trial that would be appropriate for that. And these sort of matching platforms, I think, are going to be increasingly deployed at lots of centers to enrich patient enrollment to appropriate trials.
I definitely agree on that. I mean, looking at those different types of mutations seems to be the easiest way, at least, to match up patients and get the right drug to the right patient population. But I was thinking more of immunotherapy related. I mean, that's not. I don't think that's really what you're talking about, right?
It's not. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't know that we know the right biomarkers to direct people to yet.
No, I'm just wondering how far away are we, you think, from that being something that's a reality in non-small cell lung cancer? That's one.
I think it'll be something that gets co-developed along with these new targeted drugs.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Certainly
companies are looking.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely think so, yeah.
Investing a lot in that.
So, I know we have a different type of we have a biotech here and some big pharma. So I mean, like as a biotech, I'm just going to take Steve's perspective here. When they're trying to enter into this space, non-small cell lung cancer, space with all these PD-1s present, and yes, we already talked about the different targeted approaches, but is there a certain way that maybe we can get interest in like a PD-1, company, the company that owns a PD-1, to say, hey, I should combine, rationally with such and such company, or what is there, that thought process? Like, I think we kind of discussed this in earlier panels, but just now in this context, how do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I can give you our own experience of going out and talking to companies. Again, it's a little bit different. So our target is MNK. It's essentially never mutated in cancer. And so, why did we pick it? That's a different story. But so it's a little bit different than if you had a RAS inhibitor or a targeted therapy, a MEK inhibitor, and we're trying to go after RAS or RAF mutant or something. In our case, the very clear feedback we got back was your drug does some very interesting things. Bring us very specific mechanistic information at two levels. One at a molecular mechanism. I come from another therapeutic area. It's always interesting to land in. Sick cells don't replicate and don't do the stuff they're supposed to do. So if you're just mildly putting a hurt on cell and they don't express on a cell and they don't express all the cell surface markers they're supposed to, that's really not very meaningful. If you can specifically attach a molecular mechanism, in our case it's the short 8 to 10 nucleotide sequence in front of LAG-3 that makes it MNK dependent, people go, okay, so this is real MNK biology, not general sort of sick malaise of a cell that won't express its cell surface factors. And so a couple molecular mechanistic information, if it's new biology, with some cellular immunology and show us that the right cell types are moving and that those movements correlate with the response that you see even preclinically. That was the kind of package that was required to get people interested to say, okay, this is interesting new biology, and it's been rigorously explored. I think that's probably, in our own experience, it was interesting, fairly constant across several companies who had PD-1s and PD-L1s. Tell us how it works and tell us that we should believe it's specific to your target and don't just bring us a general statement that could be, not really specific for the target that you're working on. With that, I think we found companies to be quite responsive that want to understand where the next targeted or some mechanism operating differently than directly a checkpoint antibody, how that would fit with checkpoints. There's been, with the right rigorous science, I think there's been a receptivity to look for additional mechanisms. I think generally that's true, that all the companies who have the checkpoints either approved or approaching approval are definitely interested in what else they could combine with their checkpoints.
Do we have the pharma perspective?
Well, I think that the item of combination of, just like we said here, the concept of combining PD-1 inhibitors or checkpoint inhibitors with novel agents is very in, and we are getting truly billions of opportunities. And just like Steve said, we must sort of follow the science, and it's not really a slogan, because this is an investment, and usually the way we are investing in it, what's in it for us. So there needs to be some sort of right to first refusal or some sort of something. So it is our investment of both our time and our brains of our scientists, but then a promise that, with the risk that we are taking with a novel target, that there will be a pay beyond doing this trial per se. Mm.
I agree.
So, I mean, I also think, when at least, at Defined Health, we see different types of clients. I mean, is it necessary to spark interest, to have data beyond preclinical rationale, for its utilization?
Yeah. Again, it would be very easy if you have clinical. So the whole deal is, if you have clinical data that this thing works, then it's very easy and you don't need to make a decision because you are just doing it. I think that if the science is exciting and if the science is within the unmet need, because if someone comes to us with another EGFR inhibitor, then of course the conversation is different versus someone who is coming with a completely novel target that is not served. And I think that it is all about the science behind it and about risk, our tolerance of risk, and the strength of the data. And then I think that, just like Steve said, when he was reporting the plan for development, if it is a single agent activity and proven in whatever population you are planning to investigate it for, documented single agent activity, that of course helps, but it is completely independent of the development with a PD-1 inhibitor.
Yeah, Jeff.
Thank you, James. Great panel. I want to maybe take it a little different direction at the moment. So a couple times today, starting with my talk, there was mention of GRAIL, right, trying to detect early cancer. So since this is the only, this year happens to be this, we only have one kind of indication-specific panel. So I'm very curious. We've been talking about all sorts of novel ways to advance treatment of advanced cancer patients. Right now, 40% are diagnosed with stage 4? So where are we? How are we going to be able to move? I mean, one option is, of course, to throw more different types of agents, whether IO or non-IO, at these already advanced stage patients. The other is, of course, to try and change the whole paradigm, try and diagnose it earlier, and try and intervene earlier. This is generally true for many cancers, but as the sole indication panel we have, I'd just be curious to hear everyone's kind of thoughts about kind of where we are with that, how likely it is, when it might be, whether it's GRAIL and their 900 million or something else, because it seems to me it would be a disservice to only focus on treatment of these already advanced metastatic patients.
You know, I will start because it's an extremely, extremely important question. And my answer to this is, you know, not that I have an answer, but a thought that the metastatic disease where some drugs work and some don't is a completely different disease than the early disease. So if you want to use GRAIL or whatever else to develop to start the patients early in some sort of adjuvant or whatever setting, then you have to be prepared for surprises. And if you are prepared for the surprises and you want to go there and you want to do these trials, then that's fine. But there is billion trials and billion drugs that failed in adjuvant setting despite working in metastatic setting, either because the trials were wrong or because the drugs really don't work or the driver is not there. Whatever the reason is, probably nobody knows. But you need to be prepared that you are going to a completely different area of cancer. And that's my only comment. And I don't know, Charlie, what do you think?
What do I think? I think this is a big area of research. It's clearly a big push to get there. I think the technology for the level of deep sequencing that we would actually need for truly early detection is not quite there yet, but it's getting there. And if we look back over the last 10 years of sequencing technologies and where this might go, I think we could get there. One of the challenges, of course, with that whole area is the major risk factor for lung cancer is tobacco exposure and field cancerization, and a heavy smoker has many, many, many pre-malignant lesions in the lungs. If we are at a level of detection where we can pull out from, say, blood or sputum or breath condensate particular mutations, you know, what do you do when you find a KRAS mutation in that context? What do you do when you find an EGFR? The person almost certainly has multiple lesions that have those mutations. So the next challenge beyond detection will be intervention. What does one do about that? Do we give a dose of pembrolizumab and hope that they all go away? I don't know. That would be a little bit magical thinking to think that that'll actually happen. But it's an area of active research, certainly in our group and in others, and certainly lots of investments by companies in this area. And I think it will change. I think we will get better at early detection. And then the challenge will be, as Maria says, I think the therapies that we apply in metastatic disease will not necessarily be the same that we apply in the context of inhibiting oncogenesis.
Brian Leyland-Jones. Charlie, I wanted to ask you, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about combinations in ALK-positive disease. So when you were looking at the checkpoint inhibitors, did you look at those patients that had higher PD-L1 expression, whether they worked there? And the reason I'm asking is very selfish. I have one of them. And the second question is, if you look at the famous Alice Shaw paper, New England Journal, with Jeff Engelman, beginning of last year, and it went through the 1156 and then the 1178, could we end up with a situation, as I think Jeff suggested, of treating right up front with the first and third generation inhibitor combined?
Well, I think the answer to the last question is yes. I think, you know, one strategy for these mutant tumors like an ALK-driven tumor is to try to combine multiple targeted inhibitors up front. Alice has certainly talked about this as a strategy. I think it's a reasonable one. We might not choose a bunch of inhibitors that hit exactly the same pocket. So, you know, there are second sight drugs being developed for EGFR in particular that as a single agent probably are not particularly effective, but may prevent escape from targeted inhibitors that do bind the ATP pocket. So I think combinations up front in that setting certainly are in our future. I thought you were referring to checkpoint inhibitors plus targeted inhibitors.
The first one is in your ALK positive patients that have IPD-L1 expression.
Yeah.
Do they?
The checkpoint inhibitors.
Do they?
So I don't know that they do. EGFR patients, a fair number of them do express PD-L1, but we think that's not necessarily the same pathway or the same biological mechanism as other tumors that upregulate PD-L1 in response to immune challenge. If EGFR and Kwok Wong has shown this pathway, at least in his tumor models, EGFR can upregulate PD-L1. That may or may not be relevant.
I had a quick question. Just since everyone here is working with lung cancer, if you could talk a bit about what enrollment kinetics are looking like right now in this space. How it's changed. Charlie, you mentioned the next generation sequencing letting an entire center identify very rare patients, but obviously a lot more agents competing for them too. And whatever all of these combinations are doing in terms of consuming patients, what's happening now that's new, and what do you see happening for Steve when his drug gets into phase two, for example, and everyone else's?
I feel like I've been speaking a lot.
I think that it is a very good question. What I can tell you is that we in Pfizer, we are doing a lot of trials in lung cancer because of avelumab and because of our ALK portfolio and EGFR portfolio, etc. And we do not see actually any problems with enrolling ALK-positive patients today, despite the massive choices that you have in clinic. And when you think about it, why is it so? It is probably for two reasons. One main reason that the mantra that only 3% of patients with cancer are enrolled in clinical trial is probably a mantra of 10 years ago, and it's not true anymore, because I think that there is more people who see the value of clinical trials, and there are several initiatives which actually are promoted by a big clinical centers, and those are including a clinical trial as a care option. Okay, so the physicians in big practices enroll in clinical trial because it is win-win-win-win-win, because the payer doesn't have to pay, the physician gets money for that, and the patient gets a better care. And actually, there are documented studies showing that if in this big managed care organization there is more clinical trials, then the outcomes for the patients in this managed care, in this practices that have it, is better. So I think that I wouldn't think that when Steve's drug comes that you will have troubles enrolling.
I think it's a very dynamic thing. So I hearken back to a phase one that we did at Johns Hopkins that I led, looking at the first hedgehog inhibitor. And you know, we treated a patient with metastatic basal cell cancer, and he had this dramatic response. It's incredibly rare to see a metastatic basal cell. And there were three lead investigators, myself, Dan Von Hoff, and Pat LaRusso, and we were on a conference call together. We said, gosh, this is unbelievable, but we're never going to see another patient like this. You know, but, of course, the patient blogged about his experience, and the next thing we knew, we had 30 patients with metastatic basal cell coming to the cancer center to get this drug. And Genentech was very upset with us that they thought that we had somehow leaked. But the patients were on the blog for the few patients in the world who have metastatic basal cell, and they come to the trial. So, you know, I think if you have a great drug for a great target, all of a sudden the patients appear. And a larger example, of course, would be the PD-L1, or PD-1-directed drugs, where, gosh, you know, the companies could hardly cope with the number of patients looking for enrollment onto these studies. So it changes rapidly. If you have a great drug, they come out.
Yes, and I'd concur as well. We at Merck have not seen difficulty enrolling studies either. So I think to the point Rhea was making, and Charlie, patients are becoming aware of these studies, and especially when there are blogs, we've seen this as well, then even more.
But is this mainly due to the fact that you're running your trials at certain centers? I mean, is that the case in other centers, you know, smaller, more regional centers that might also have clinical trials available? Are they enrolling patients at the same speed, or is there such a high demand, you know, at those smaller referral centers?
Yeah, and there's also, you know, the big industry of trial recruiters. So there is more centers for clinical trials than there used to be. So,
right.
I think we have bigger problems than trial enrollment.
How big of an issue is checkpoint resistance, really? So we hear a lot about it today. In melanoma, you see flattening of the KM curves. In non-small cell lung, either squamous or non-squamous, to my untrained eye, it seems perhaps less durable for a checkpoint. So are there unifying themes, and I won't ask Merck or Pfizer to reveal specific targets, but along the same lines as identifying and marketing EGFR, next-gen EGFR inhibitors, next-gen ALK inhibitors, are we ever going to get there with PD-1, or are the mechanisms of resistance too diffuse to target with any one specific mechanism of action from a drug?
I mean, this is an area that is of great scientific interest, I think, both to the companies and to academicians, clinicians, the treating physicians. And so there is a lot of investigation that's going on, I think primarily between the companies and different academic centers. And then there are even some nonprofit initiatives as well that are taking place to try and fund and explore this. I think as you're alluding to, it may not necessarily be like it is for EGFR and ALK. Okay, we can pinpoint this other mutation that suddenly explains why there's resistance now, and the answer is probably going to be a lot more complex, but there are efforts going on to trying to identify other pathways that could be contributing to this.
Yeah, I agree, and it's probably too early to speculate on it, especially that there are, you know, if you look at the curves, there is this 10% or 15% or whatever, and then they eventually will relapse, hopefully not. But there is also reports of patients who were on PD-1 inhibitor or some sort of checkpoint inhibitor recurred, were retreated, and responded again. And I don't know whether you can comment on it, but I don't think that there is enough, you know, in my opinion, I don't think that we know exactly where to look for the mutation, for the resistance, because it's so many things that can contribute to the resistance that...
I mean, I'll just offer a little bit of comment. So when we think about this, when we think about immune evasion, this is natural biology first, that the whole reaction exists for a reason to prevent collateral damage when you've launched an immune attack. That is as complex as the original immune reaction. There's a second set of multiple coordinated events that happen to coordinate that. But that is a coherent biological reaction. That's not randomly a bunch of things happening, and all of them contribute to or can contribute to any given tumor not being available to be recognized and attacked by the immune system. So we have tried very hard to go after central mechanisms that are common to multiple different elements within that. Because, again, it's a biological step. It isn't a bunch of different things happening. It evolved for a reason, and it evolved in a very coordinated way, the way, you know, biology does evolve. It sort of makes sense when you see the pattern. So I think there are opportunities to understand what are various different mechanisms of resistance. I doubt that any one patient will have exactly one pathway fully activated and that made them resistant and all the other pathways are quiescent. I think you'll see varying modulations of different aspects of what we think of as a common reaction. If you can control multiple aspects of that simultaneously, I think there's a good chance that you could overcome more than one resistance mechanism that may be somewhat more prevalent or more dominant in one patient than another one.
Hi, I'm Andrew Bush from Central Jersey. Dr. Rudin, I wanted to ask you a question. You talked about at Sloan Kettering that you are doing sequencing and you're trying to have that guide in as best way possible what drugs patients get. I'm sure everyone on the panel knows that we don't really understand, with still limited exceptions, what causes advanced metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. We know about EGFR, we know about ALK, but aside from that, there's a lot we don't know. So my question to you is, I'm sorry if I missed it, but are you making public these learnings you have? Have you published anything on this? Because I'm also expecting, you know, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, understandably, but we can all learn from those hypotheses that turn out to be inaccurate. And if I've missed the paper, please let me know.
Yeah, it isn't out yet, but we are actually writing this up. There's a it's in resubmission right now, showing our experience with it within lung cancer. What did we do with this information? What did the patients get? How many of the patients who had a targetable alteration actually got a targeted drug? How many did not? Why not? Those data are all kind of in that. It's totally observational, of course, but it's an interesting data set because now we have enough to actually look at. So yeah, it's forthcoming. We thought it would be worth putting out there. And you're right, a lot of the information is not used, you know, of course. We don't know what to do with it all. But I think over time, as this data set grows, it'll become increasingly informative.
All right. Well, if there's no more questions, I think we had a really successful panel, a lot of great discussion, and I'd like to thank our panelists, and you can go off to reception.